Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. As kind of a prelude to our next segment, I want to play a 30-second soundbite from the year 1952. The speaker is running for the Republican nomination for president. Spoiler alert, he didn't get it. The nominee that year was General Dwight Eisenhower, a World War II hero who, of course, would go on to win the election and be a two-term president. But this candidate, who we will hear, was the governor of California at the time. His name was Earl Warren. And in a campaign interview on the fancy new 1952 medium called television, he made a standard Republican argument that the 20 years of FDR and Harry Truman gave Washington too much power over the states.
I'm thoroughly out of sympathy, and always have been, with the efforts of this administration, and I refer to it as the 20-year administration, of centralizing all administrative power in Washington. I believe that they have weakened our institutions. I believe that they have detracted from the efficiency and the importance of both state and local government.
California Governor Earl Warren running for president in 1952. Why did I play that clip? The answer will be revealed as we welcome our next guests, University of Chicago law professors Jeffrey Stone and David Strauss. They have a new book together called Democracy and Equality, the Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. Professor Stone, welcome back, and Professor Strauss, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
And I'll bet that many of our listeners who have heard of Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren and the landmark decisions he presided over, like Brown versus Board of Education, had no idea he was governor of California, no less a Republican or a contender for the Republican presidential nomination in 1952. Were you having any thoughts about Warren or Brown versus Board or anything else as you listened to that clip?
I was, actually, Brian. I mean, it is a kind of remarkable transformation in one sense from a Republican politician, a more or less generic Republican politician, to a Chief Justice who can really be regarded as visionary. And I think it's a comment both on Warren himself, obviously, and on what times were like back then when someone who was appointed to the Supreme Court realized, okay, it's time for me to stop being what I was, which was an extremely successful Republican politician, and start thinking about the problems confronting the nation as a whole and what I might do about them.
So Dwight Eisenhower wins the presidency and appoints one of his main rivals for the nomination as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Was it right away as Chief Justice, or first onto the bench and then the elevation came later?
He was appointed right away to Chief Justice. The Chief Justiceship became vacant because the previous Chief Justice had died and Warren appointed him. There is, I think, a rumor, I don't know if it's been confirmed, that it was at least an implicit deal that Warren would support Eisenhower's nomination and in return become Chief Justice.
Huh. Is that weird, though, in the history of the court, putting an outsider right into Chief Justice rather than elevating an associate justice when Chief becomes open?
No, it's actually the norm. It's actually rare for a justice to be elevated. And there's a reason for that, which is that when you become Chief Justice, whether you're coming from the outside or the inside, there's another confirmation hearing. And the concern is that if you elevate a member of the court, that confirmation hearing will review all of the court's work, and senators will get to criticize and attack the court's work and demand an accounting of the court's work. And that's not the way the system's supposed to be operating.
So in 1952, Warren is running for president, critiquing federal power, as we heard in that clip. 1953, he's appointed Chief Justice. 1954, he leads the court in Brown versus Board of Education, rebuking the states' rights argument on Jim Crow school segregation. Was it an evolution for Earl Warren, or something an observer at the time who knew his background could have predicted?
I don't know that people could have predicted it. I think that in some ways it was a bit of a surprise. But Warren was pretty clear on it after he got on the court, that it was the responsibility of the court to take seriously the rights guaranteed in the Constitution, and particularly the rights of African Americans.
And Brown versus Board is one of 12 landmark decisions between 1954 and 1969 that you revisit in your book. We'll go down the list in a minute. But is there a reason that has to do with today that you wrote a book about this old Supreme Court era now?
Well, partly it was because this was the 50th anniversary of the end of the Warren Court. But in some ways, more importantly, it's that the Warren Court itself has been subject to a harsh criticism by conservatives for the last 60 years. And we agree that the Warren Court's basic approach to constitutional interpretation is the correct one, and that it's important for people to understand that there is a sensible, sound, and justified approach to constitutional law and to the responsibilities of the Supreme Court that is evident in the working of the Warren Court, and that's very much lacking today.
And maybe we should say that the Warren Court did not give us Roe versus Wade. That came in 1973, 4 years after Warren retired. But it did give us the predecessor case, Griswold versus Connecticut, in 1965, which is one of the ones you write about in the book. Can you talk about Griswold versus Connecticut and why you chose to include it?
Well, Griswold involved the question of whether states could prohibit married couples to have access to contraception. And historically, it's an interesting phenomenon. It used to be the case that both abortion and contraception were freely available and not illegal anywhere in the country. That began to change in the 19th century. And by the time we get to the early 20th century, every state was prohibiting this. By the time you get to Griswold, most states had changed their laws and access to contraception was permissible, but a few states still prohibit it. And the Supreme Court came to the view that it is a right of individual privacy for a married couple to decide for itself whether or not it will use contraception. And the state should not be intruding into a matter that is so personal and private and in some ways fundamental to the nature of the marriage relationship. So it was, by the time the court decided it, it was legally a kind of controversial decision, but politically much less so.
You just said something that I think a lot of listeners might not know. Did I hear you right? Abortion was legal in the United States at the founding of this country, and only eventually into the 19th century got outlawed state by state?
Correct. At the time of the creation of the United States, abortion was legal everywhere, and it was fairly common. It was common pretty much through the mid-19th century. It was only really the second half of the 19th century that states began prohibiting abortion. And if you ask the framers about the issue of abortion, they would not have thought of it as a constitutional right because no one would ever have even thought about restricting it. So I'm sure it never occurred to them that it should be thought of as a constitutional right. But they took for granted the fact that abortion and contraception were routinely available to individuals, married and unmarried, at the time the Constitution was adopted. And that really didn't change until the second half of the 19th century.
The Warren Court also gave us Miranda versus Arizona in 1966. This wasn't Lin-Manuel Miranda who wrote Hamilton, but this Miranda might actually be much more consequential in American history. Can you tell us about Miranda versus Arizona?
Yeah, Miranda against Arizona, and that Miranda was really not himself a particularly estimable guy. He was a criminal suspect. He had probably committed some crimes. But it was a response to something that police departments were routinely doing throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, into the 1960s, which was arresting a suspect, taking him to the station house, not telling him he was entitled to a lawyer, and questioning him for a long time under difficult conditions. Sometimes they used outright physical torture, and there's no question that was unconstitutional. But the question about just how far they could go in applying psychological pressure, keep them there a long time, don't allow them to see any friends or relatives, much less a lawyer, ask him questions designed to kind of trap him into confessing, maybe even if he was innocent. That was something that police departments routinely took advantage of. The Supreme Court saw case after case after case, and found itself saying in many of those cases, no, that was coercive, that was too likely to produce a false confession, or even if it wasn't, it was not the way we should treat criminal suspects. So finally, in Miranda, they said, look, we've had enough of this. Here's the deal, police departments. You have to give a person these warnings. You have to warn him he has a right to remain silent. You have to warn him that anything he says can be used against him. You have to warn him that he's entitled to a lawyer and he can have one appointed if he can't pay for it. And that's the deal. And if you don't give him those warnings and you question him anyway, you're not going to be allowed to use any statements he makes. So it's really a way for the Supreme Court to try to break out of the system in which the police were just getting as close as they possibly could to the edge of what was legal. At the time, Miranda was criticized extensively and really vituperatively by opponents of the Warren Court, not just Republicans and Democrats alike, although there were many Republicans, including, of course, Earl Warren himself, who thought it was a good decision. One interesting thing is 20 or 30 years later, Miranda came before the court in a different posture. The question was really whether the court should allow Miranda to be eviscerated. And far from eviscerating it, the Supreme Court upheld it and said, look, it's part of the fabric now. Police departments use this. Our experience with it has been good. The person who announced that decision was William Rehnquist, the most conservative member of the court, of the most conservative person that was appointed by the opponents of the Warren Court, and a famously conservative justice. And he began his announcement of this opinion upholding Miranda by reciting the Miranda warnings in the Supreme Court. So it moved from being an extremely controversial decision that was the basis for these attacks on the Warren Court to something that is completely settled and accepted as a good thing.
In fact, my understanding is that police departments have come to like the Miranda warning requirement because it gives them clear rules and actually makes it easier for arrests and prosecutions to hold up in court.
That's right. Good police departments want that. They want the clarity. They want the guidance. They want to know what we need to do. It's the shady ones who don't like it. And as police, Miranda was part of a trend in which a lot of police departments got modernized, and this was part of it. I should also say that Miranda was also tied into what was really in many ways the central preoccupation of the Warren Court, which, as Jeff mentioned earlier, was the treatment of African Americans. And the worst of these interrogation practices were conducted in the Jim Crow South against African American defendants. And Miranda wasn't just about that, but it was definitely partly about that.
And I want to emphasize that because it's such a theme of your book and a way to view history. The several criminal justice decisions on this list, Miranda, which is the right to know your right to a lawyer, et cetera, before you incriminate yourself, plus the decisions here on illegal police searches, and the right to have an attorney, even if you can't afford to pay one, in the Gideon versus Wainwright 1963 decision. These don't always get discussed as civil rights rulings, like Brown versus Board, but you really frame them that way in the book. Why is that?
I think it is an overstatement, but only a slight overstatement, to say that everything the Warren Court did was about race. Now, that's not quite right. But it was race-infused, what the Warren Court did about criminal defendants' rights, about one person, one vote, as well as you said, Brian, the decisions that obviously had to do with race, like Brown against Board of Education. I should also mention something that Jeff is the country's leading expert on, which is free speech. Some of the Warren Court's most important free speech decisions, including maybe its single most important free speech decision, came out of efforts by the Jim Crow South to stifle, specifically the New York Times, when it was reporting on civil rights demonstrations in the South. So that has come down to us as a First Amendment case, a terribly important First Amendment case, but it too, in many ways, was also about race.
Tell us that story, Professor Stone. This is the Freedom of the Press case called New York Times versus Sullivan, 1964, a major freedom of the press ruling. What was the civil rights context?
Well, during the height of the civil rights movement and the years after Brown and Board of Education, southern states did not want publicity for many of the actions they were taking against civil rights protesters. And therefore, one of the many strategies they adopted was to essentially encourage lawsuits by public officials against the newspapers, particularly northern newspapers, who were covering these stories, alleging that they had made false statements about the behavior of the southern public officials and seeking damages for libel. And up until that time, the general law of libel said that if you made a statement that defamed the reputation of someone, that is, if you said something critical about them, then you would be held liable for defamation unless you could prove the truth of the statement. And what was happening in the South is that newspapers occasionally made inaccurate statements, inevitably. And in New York Times and Sullivan, Sullivan was the commissioner of police in Montgomery, Alabama, and he sued the New York Times because it had allowed an advertisement designed to raise money for the civil rights supporters. And in it, there were a couple of very technical minor inaccuracies. And an Alabama jury found, A, that it was false, and then, B, awarded extraordinary damages, $600,000 in damages, which in those days were a huge amount of money. And this was all basically an effort to drive northern newspapers out of the South and to prevent them from covering any of these sorts of stories at all. And the Supreme Court then said that, no, the First Amendment does not allow that, that if a speaker, whether it's a newspaper or an individual, makes a statement that defames a public official with respect to his performance of his public duties, that, and even if it is false, they cannot be held liable unless the plaintiff can prove, A, that it was false, and B, that the speaker acted with reckless disregard of the truth. And that made a profound difference in American First Amendment doctrine. And it was very much driven by the circumstances of the civil rights movement, but it's had an extraordinarily positive effect on American democracy in the years since.
We'll continue in a minute with University of Chicago law professors Jeffrey Stone and David Strauss. Their new book is called Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. We'll go over a few more of the 12 cases they describe in that book from the 1954 to 1969 era of the Earl Warren-led Supreme Court, including the Prayer in Schools case, Engel versus Vitale, 1962, which many people say started the contemporary culture wars. We're also going to get to a couple of news questions, like maybe their thoughts on Chief Justice Roberts' coming role in the impeachment trial, maybe Pete Buttigieg's proposal to expand the Supreme Court to 15 judges, justices, and a couple of phone calls if you want to get in, folks, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with University of Chicago law professors Jeffrey Stone and David Strauss, authors now of Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court, and Bud in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hello. Hi. How are you? I was wondering if your guests have any comment on Earl Warren's legacy with respect to what happened prior to his appointment to the on the Supreme Court. And that is with the internment of the Japanese in California during World War II. When I went to law school, a professor said, who wrote Brown versus the Board of Education? And it was the answer is the same person who 10 years before was segregating the Japanese in this country. Do your professors have any comment on his legacy with respect to that?
Thank you, Bud. Professors? Well,
yeah, it's true that after Pearl Harbor, when the nation instituted a program of ultimately detaining 120,000 people of Japanese descent in the United States, Warren, who was governor of California, or actually was attorney general of California at the time, supported that program and advocated the importance of it. The concern was that given that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, that there was a risk that they would then attack the west coast of the United States. In fact, there was really very little risk of that, but people panicked, and it became one of the great misgivings and mistakes in American political history. And Warren, as Attorney General of California, defended that and advocated it. And later in his career, he expressed his regret for having done so, and said that he had been mistaken and he'd been moved too much by the panic of the moment. But it is certainly part of his legacy, and it's something that Warren certainly was not proud of.
Yeah, let me just add, I think the question's totally fair, and what Jeff said is right. It was a disgraceful episode in the career of Earl Warren. And it also, it teaches you something about both how people can change and how important it is to try to make sure that you're not getting caught up in the bad things that are going on in the era in which you live. Because Earl Warren was a proponent of the Japanese internment. The person who wrote the Supreme Court opinion saying it was constitutional was Hugo Black, one of the great civil libertarians in the history of the Supreme Court and one of the intellectual engines of the Warren Court. One of the leading opponents of the Japanese internment was none other than J. Edgar Hoover. Who, of course, in his career turned out to be sort of a violator of civil liberties and basically kind of terrible on those issues.
Well, more to this
having
point,
said that,
a listener named Yoichi on Twitter writes to us, Justice Warren supported Japanese internment and deeply regretted it later. Now many historians think his liberal court is the act of atonement. Do you see it that way at all?
I doubt that. I think, you're dealing with people who are put in a different position. He's Chief Justice. He's matured a little bit. He no longer has to worry about running for office. And I think he's now thinking, what are the problems facing the country and what can I do about them? And one of the big problems was Jim Crow segregation. But I can't imagine he would have done anything differently as a Chief Justice had he managed to be on the right side of the Japanese internment issue.
The prayer in schools case. Engel versus Vitale, 1962. I think people to this day are so confused about what the court actually said that you can do and cannot do with respect to prayer in schools, and it gets misrepresented as an anti-religion ruling when it was really a religious freedom ruling. What was Engel versus Vitale?
Well, the issue was whether public schools could have prayer typically at the beginning of the school day, that did not exist in the United States until the latter part of the 19th century, particularly with the immigration of Jewish and particularly Catholics into the United States. And that led to a sense of what are these people doing here? Schools that were predominantly dominated by Protestants began imposing Protestant-type prayers into the public schools. And this created a real problem for many students, because if they did not share the views that were being encapsulated in those prayers, they were usually not required to say the prayers, but they still had to sort of stand there and make clear to everybody else, I don't believe what you believe. And what the Supreme Court concluded in Engel v. Vitale is that it is a violation of a freedom of religion to essentially both endorse a particular version of religious belief in this way, to have a government entity endorse a particular vision of religious belief. And second, it was a serious intrusion on the freedom of religion of people who didn't share those views, who had to basically make clear to everybody else, I don't share your views in this very public way. And so the court said that it violates the First Amendment for schools to have a school prayer at the beginning of the day. It was a very controversial decision, in many ways very unpopular. But again, like all of the Warren Court decisions we talk about in the book, it has stood the test of time, and it remains the law. It did not prohibit teaching about religion in schools. It did not prohibit reading the Bible for the purpose of understanding what the Bible said as an academic matter, as opposed to a specific religious document.
Did not prohibit students from praying in school, including out loud, right?
It prohibited the school from defining a prayer and having the student say it, correct?
Right, and we've had at least one call from a listener who told a first-person story of growing up Jewish in a mostly Christian area and having the school, somebody representing the school, read an organized Christian prayer at the beginning of the school day once upon a time before this decision, and that it made her feel intimidated and very uncomfortable. And it was cases like that that inspired it. But you know, that case and several other of the Warren Court rulings get cited, especially by conservatives, as having started the culture wars. The reason Ronald Reagan rose to power and Jerry Falwell all the way to Mike Pence and William Barr, and then Donald Trump capitalized it on it, was because these decisions that you herald in the book as about democracy and equality left certain kinds of cultural traditionalists feeling discriminated against themselves and aggrieved. Do you accept that version of history?
I don't. I think that sort of mixes up cause and effect in a way. What was going on was the country was becoming more diverse, was becoming heterogeneous. As Jeff said, there were Jewish immigrants, there were Catholic immigrants, African Americans were tired of being second-class citizens, women were tired of being second-class citizens. Those were the things going on in the country. What the Warren Court did was a response, a measured response, an appropriate response to that. But the reaction you identified from what you described accurately as the culture wars, that was a reaction to what was going on in the country. That would have happened anyway. Even if the Warren Court hadn't done anything like what it did, we would have seen that reaction because it was a reaction to the country moving in a direction that some people didn't want it to move in, but in which it was inevitably moving.
All right, we're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes. Can I touch a few news items with you? Any thoughts about Chief Justice Roberts' coming role in the impeachment trial, since you are Supreme Court scholars? Most of what we hear is that he doesn't really have the power of a trial judge or hardly any power at all. Agree?
Yes, I agree, and I think he thinks that's a good thing. I think the last thing he would want is to be in a position where he is a decisive or even important actor in this. I think he understands correctly that would be very damaging both to his historical reputation and the court he leads.
It came up earlier in the show that since he plays the vice president's role, usual role of presiding over the Senate, and the vice president has the right to break a 50-50 tie, Chief Justice Roberts would have that right, but the speculation was he will never exercise it. Do you think both halves of that are right? Does he even have the right?
I guess the first half is right. This is really, I mean, who knows, because it's such a rare event. We really don't know how this is supposed to work, but I think probably he has the right. But speaking of prayer in schools, I am sure he is praying that the occasion does not arise when he has to exercise it, and will try to figure out a way not to be in that position.
Either of you want to comment on Pete Buttigieg's idea to, as I understand it, expand the court from 9 to 15 justices, but to fight partisanship, have the first 10 justices appoint the other 5 rather than the president appoint them?
Well, I don't know about that specific idea. I do think that some norms have been broken about the Supreme Court, and we need to figure out a way to restore them. And increasingly, the Supreme Court is being used, the whole judiciary is being used as an instrument of partisan warfare. That's a new thing. One of the points we make in the book is that that was not at all the deal with the Warren Court. It was not a partisan institution. As you said, when your leader, Warren, is a Republican, there are other Republicans who were in leadership roles in the Warren Court. There were Democratic dissenters from the Warren Court. That's a new thing, and we need to break out of that somehow and keep the Supreme Court from being just another partisan institution.
And last thing, can you give me a quick take on current Supreme Court term cases in the context of your book, if any? Are there any Warren Court precedents that are getting new conservative looks?
I don't think there are any of the ones we talked about in our book that will get a new look in this term. One interesting thing, actually, is that of the Warren Court precedents that have come under the most sustained attack in later courts, it's not really ones we talk about in the book. It is ones that gave more power to Congress. So the Warren Court has this image of being a power-hungry court that put the courts in charge of America. A lot of what it did was to expand the power of Congress, and it's those decisions that later courts, for example, in the Affordable Care Act case, have tried to cut back on.
University of Chicago law professors Jeffrey Stone and David Strauss, their new book is Democracy and Equality, the Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.